and how beautiful the symbolism behind us, this huge crowd right in the backyard of the White House.
Energized by a new administration, thousands march in Washington, D.C. to rally against legal abortion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the dark side of traditional Aurora stories.
The northern lights are out. Guess what? They're gonna chop your head off and you're gonna play with your head like a football.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Your health matters. Tuesday, January 31st is the last day to enroll in the health insurance marketplace. Information at getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
Business and community leaders have told state officials they'd like to see new sources of money to finance economic development. That was among the early findings of a state effort to build a comprehensive strategy to develop Alaska's economy. State Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development Chris Laddick says the strategy could lead to a summit of business leaders and a long-term effort to build a partnership between the state and the private sector.
You need to build this from the bottom up. You have to have industry and private enterprise involved in the process. And we're talking about a decade, if not longer, is what you really need to do to see results.
Northern Opportunity is the state's name for its comprehensive economic development strategy. A draft will be prepared this year, but state leaders expect it will take much longer for the strategy to improve the business climate. State officials say there's interest in expanding the use of microfinancing and crowdfunding, as well as expanding state financing. They're drawing on the experience of regional economic development organizations. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee heard testimony from regional leaders yesterday. Anchorage Economic Development Corporation President and CEO Bill Popp says research points to opportunities for pharmaceutical companies to expand operations in the state.
We have by no means proven that this is a slam dunk opportunity, but it's a great first indicator that we've got something to work with here if we can just sort out the other things related to the cost of doing business here.
Southeast Conference completed a five-year strategic plan for the region last year. Economic development planner Melani Shiven says job losses in state government are putting a drag on Southeast Alaska's economy.
The real question, of course, is how the impact of the state fiscal crisis will impact the regional economy.
Laddick notes past economic development efforts have ended when new administrations take office. So he says it's important that the private sector take a lead role in any future strategy. It was another day of mass demonstration in Washington, D.C. today, this time for the March for Life, an anti-abortion protest that's been held annually since 1974. APRN's Liz Ruskin waded through the crowd and found a contingent from Eagle River and the Catholic chaplain from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson.
Father Pete Pompasello stood in the shadow of the Washington Monument and looked over the crowd.
As you're looking at banners from all over the East Coast, Midwest. There's a group here from Scotland. We came in from Alaska. And it's just a sea of all these colors and everybody, you know, just trying to stay warm.
Much has been made of Washington crowd sizes lately. But Pompasello was, at that moment, just soaking it all in.
And how beautiful the symbolism behind us, this huge crowd right in the backyard of the White House.
There were hundreds, maybe thousands, of clergymen present, to judge by the callers. But Pompasello may have been the only priest who is also an active duty Army paratrooper. He's with the 501st Airborne at J-Bear. The change of administration has the anti-abortion movement cheering. Pompasello is optimistic, too, but he takes the long view.
This is going to go the way of slavery. It's going to be over. If not in their time, certainly in their kids' time, these high school kids, when they have kids.
With him were Ricky Shoup, the youth minister at St. Andrews in Eagle River, and five students. Eagle River mom Michelle Roth came as a chaperone.
It's really great to see the impact of the event for the kids, and it's inspirational.
Father Pompasello has attended about 18 of these annual marches up Constitution Avenue to the U.S. Supreme Court. He has his traditions, so as the small Alaska contingent walked with the crowd carrying state flags, the paratrooper priest led them in the rosary.
Death doesn't get the last word, so we go to the glorious mysteries. The first glorious mysteries.
Reporting from the National Mall, I'm Liz Ruskin.
When Alaska legislators or their immediate family members financially benefit from bills, the lawmakers declare they have a conflict of interest. But as long as one other legislator objects to the recusal, the person with the conflict is still required to vote. Anchorage Representative Jason Gran wants to change that to requiring a majority of members to agree to the objection, forcing the lawmaker to vote. Gren's proposed two bills would make it harder for people to vote on issues that might financially benefit themselves.
There's no target with this bill outside of wanting to build public trust and add transparency to what we do as 60 members of the legislature.
Gren is an independent who caucuses with the mostly Democratic House majority. He says Alaska is the only state in the country that makes it so easy for lawmakers with conflicts of interest to vote. Republicans have met the bills with skepticism, saying it unfairly targets legislators who work for oil and gas companies. Eagle River Representative Laura Reinbold noted that some members of the House majority want to change oil and gas tax policies in a way that would require the companies to pay more. She asked Gren about that during a House Judiciary Committee hearing today.
Is there any motivation in any way to alienate or target anybody associated with the oil and gas industry?
Gren says he was motivated by increasing transparency. The League of Women Voters supports the bills. League member Margot Waring read a statement from League President Pat Redman.
We often hear supporters of the current practice say that to not vote is to deprive a district of its voice. The answer to that is that a vote cast under a cloud also deprives voters of knowing that the vote was cast for the benefit of the district and the state.
Former lawmaker Mike Bradner helped write the rule that allows those with conflicts of interest to vote. He says the new bills present practical challenges.
I consider my senator obligated to vote whether I like his vote or not. Now, at election time, I may take a different view.
Bradner would like to see the rules stay like they are. Members declare their conflicts, they are allowed to vote, and those conflicts are covered by the news media. One of Gren's bills, House Bill 44, would change the law, while the other, House Concurrent Resolution 1, would change House rules. The bills could be discussed by the Judiciary Committee again as soon as Monday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the end of our series examining John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country.
It became my life, and I was there because I really wanted to be there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local federal subsistence regional advisory council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
Sitka's docks will look a bit different this summer. The Coast Guard cutter Maple will sail south for maintenance and then be reassigned a new home port in the spring. As KCAW's Emily Russell reports, that will leave Sitka without a large Coast Guard vessel for at least 6 months.
Lieutenant Commander Patrick Armstrong is the officer in charge of the Coast Guard cutter Maple.
There's been so many hours put on the engines and the generators, and, you know, just things need to be rebuilt and, you know, wiring and a lot of the engineering type stuff needs to be basically overhauled and just looked at. So there's nothing specifically wrong with the ship that's requiring anything. It's just a general midlife maintenance.
The Maple was commissioned in the mid-90s. Armstrong says it's among more than a dozen other cutters now in need of a tune-up. Once work on the Maple is done, the 225-foot vessel will have a new home port in Atlantic Beach, North Carolina. Although the cutter will have a new home, Armstrong says its crew won't go with it.
Here in Sitka, nothing will change in terms of the personnel or the transfers, only the ship itself. So basically, in the end, it'll just really be a name change for the ship.
That name is the Kukui. The 225-foot cutter is currently homeported in Honolulu, Hawaii, and has long ties to the state, getting its name from Hawaii's state tree. Like the Maple, it was designed to service navigation buoys.
It's essentially the same thing, just a few minor engineering configurations on board, but it's really the same class of ship.
Along with being in the same class, it was also commissioned around the same time. So the Kukui II will get midlife maintenance done in Baltimore before sailing on to Sitka. But Armstrong says that won't happen until 2018. That means Sitka will be without a Coast Guard cutter for at least 6 months.
Without having a ship, we won't be sailing and doing our normal ATON mission and search and rescue missions. Instead, our crew will be focusing on training and maintaining proficiency.
Armstrong says search and rescue efforts will be well covered in the area with the help of Air Station Sitka and Coast Guard Sector Juneau. And he expects the Kukui to sail into Sitka's harbor in the spring of 2018. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
Water is flowing across a section of the Richardson Highway south of Paxson. Department of Transportation Northern Region spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says flooding is an issue between milepost 184 and 186.
We're not sure what is causing this exactly. We don't know if there's been some change in, you know, there definitely, it's an area where there are some small streams that flow off the hillside. So we don't know if there's been a diversion in those streams or there's something that's clogged. That's what we're investigating right now.
Bailey says the road is passable.
If you're coming through here, you should expect that there possibly will be lane restrictions and some delays because we have so much maintenance equipment in the area working. We're trying to thaw those pipes and we are trying to clear the water off the surface.
Bailey notes driving conditions have been sketchy along the section of highway south of Paxson over the last 2 weeks.
From ice to having extreme snowstorms to the avalanches. So our crews have been working really hard, facing some unusual challenges.
An avalanche briefly closed the highway at milepost 209 last week, and Bailey says a few smaller snowslides have come down since, following a several-day storm. When writer John McPhee arrived on the Yukon River in the mid-1970s, he encountered men and women living as far from civilization as they could manage. Many had settled on federal land, but their cabins, trap lines, and mining claims were so remote they escaped the government's notice. But as McPhee documents in his book Coming into the Country, this was all about to end. Yesterday we heard the story of a husband and wife who opposed the changes that took place when the area became a national preserve. Today, we're hearing from a couple McPhee encountered on the Yukon, and they have a different take. Elizabeth Harbaugh has the story.
For a decade, beginning in 1974, Steve Olvey and Lynette Roberts lived hundreds of miles from the nearest city in a cabin they built near the Yukon River. When I ask Steve and Lynette how they did it, they answer without hesitation.
Stubbornness.
I was going to say the same thing.
The two arrived in Alaska when Steve was just 23 and Lynette 25. They were college dropouts and hippies, although they prefer the term counterculturalists. Inspired by the works of Henry David Thoreau, Edward Abbey, and Dick Prenicky, Steve envisioned a simple life connected to nature. Lynette had no such vision, but she was in love with Steve.
I wasn't going to let him go alone. If I was welcome, I was going to go.
Things weren't easy at first. They scraped by in a 15x15 cabin with Steve's brother. There weren't as many animals to hunt as Steve had guessed. And Steve says there was something else about the country they weren't entirely prepared for.
Winter is the dominant feature, and it drives everything else. That was something that no matter how much you might read about it or how much you might think about it, there's nothing that prepares you for that day in and day out.
That first unglamorous winter, broke, cold, and sick of being the only woman around, Lynette got fed up and left. She ended up in Tok, not having the money to go further, and picked up work at a cafe. But after getting a little space and time to herself, Lynette went back.
I think Steve was quite shocked to see me because he thought I was gone for good, but it just didn't seem right that I would leave for good.
Over the next 10 years, the couple learned to trap, planted gardens, built up a dog team, and made their own clothes. Eventually, Lynette and Steve had two children. Lynette says living in the bush made them a stronger family. As time passed, she came to love living there as much as Steve.
It became my life, and I was there because I really wanted to be there, not just because that's where I was.
John McPhee encountered Steve and Lynette 2 years after the couple's arrival, when they were just getting the hang of things. In Coming Into the Country, McPhee introduces Steve as a cinematically handsome man, helping another river dweller, Dick Cook, load up a canoe with supplies. It was spring, and the Yukon was roiling with giant chunks of ice. McPhee was standing on the riverbank when the two shoved off and watched as a massive ice floe hit their canoe.
Blood ran out of Cook's face. His skin became as pale as the floes in the river. If more ice were to strike the canoe now, it would crumple up like an aluminum can. Ulvie wrenched the bow free and shoved the canoe backward. Once more, it floated among the ice.
When he reflects on his near-death experience in the icy Yukon, Ulvie says McPhee played a bigger role in the scene than the book lets on.
Dick Cook loved to talk, and of course McPhee's job was made easier the more somebody talked. And so I'm in the bow, so McPhee and Cook are talking and talking and talking. And I think that what happened is that Dick just got a little frustrated and just kind of gave us a little shove with his paddle, and we slid down the ice floe into the water at exactly the wrong time.
Even though McPhee's reporting nearly saw Steve meet a frigid end, he is full of praise for Coming Into the Country.
He captured it exquisitely. I just can't say enough about how well he did at capturing those feelings and that sense of change.
Steve only gets a few mentions in Coming Into the Country, but he was swept up in the changes McPhee chronicled in his book. In the 1970s, oil started flowing down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Soon after, Congress inked the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
I call that the Great Partitioning of Alaska occurred in the 70s and into 80. And in some ways, I also feel that that was the end of old Alaska.
Many of the river people McPhee had profiled found themselves living in a national preserve. After years of successfully avoiding government interference, they started to receive trespass notices and began clashing with federal officials. At first, Steve and Lynette stayed out of it because they had settled with permission on native land. But in 1981, Steve took a job as a park ranger for the Yukon Charley National Preserve, and so began
many years of controversy, of not being able to attend local parties without the topic coming up.
People who had built cabins on federal land now needed permits to live there. Those permits were gradually phased out. Hunting and trapping were allowed to continue, but new rules and limits were enforced. Steve says he understands why people were upset, and he doesn't agree with how all the regulations were carried out. But in the end, he also doesn't think the Park Service deserves all the animosity it got.
I've often said, you know, you can get in more trouble stepping on a person's dreams than you will stepping on their reality. And Alaska is a dream landscape.
Because the area is a national preserve, Steve says that dream landscape has been protected. Today, visitors can come to the Yukon Charley National Preserve, take a canoe down the river, and enjoy a wilderness that's mostly unchanged from when Steve and Lynette arrived there in 1974. And Steve says that's something to be proud of. From Alaska's Energy Desk, with help from Eric Keto, this is Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. January 31st is the last day to enroll in the health insurance marketplace. For assistance in your area, go to getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, statewide stargazing. One of the most spectacular sights in Alaska is a good aurora show, but a new film is casting the Northern Lights as something more than a mere novelty. Through a mix of science, art, and traditional knowledge, researchers in Alaska are trying to tell a more comprehensive story about the aurora. And, as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes found out, the result is a dazzling glimpse of the Northern Lights, but without the cold.
I'm leaning back in a comfy chair at the University of Alaska Planetarium in Anchorage, and all across the dome overhead are ribbons of green light dancing above the North Slope.
What are the Northern Lights? How do they fit into the natural world? What meaning do they hold for those who live beneath their splendor?
Narrator Patok Glenn guides the show, a mix of time-lapsed aurora videos from around the state with interviews and different explanations for the phenomenon known as the Northern Lights.
According to the ancient oral tradition, the Kiwiut, or Northern Lights, are spirits of people playing a game of soccer in the sky.
Some accountings are a lot scarier.
The lights are prone to swooping down to earth to cut off the heads of the unwary.
One of the stars of the movie is Fanny Akpik, an elder in Utqiagvik. As a kid, she says the warnings of decapitation were a way to get children into bed. At around 9:30, she recalls, kids started to worry.
The Northern Lights are out. Guess what? They're gonna chop your head off and they're gonna play with your head like a football.
Other elders from Inupiaq communities in the high north tell stories of using the lights for winter travel, or how they helped to define the seasons of the year. Those lived experiences under the auroras is augmented by a scientific accounting of why they happen in the first place. It starts with ejections from the surface of the sun that send charged particles hurtling through space.
It takes 1 to 4 days for the highly charged solar particles to reach Earth.
The planet's magnetic field deflects most of that solar wind, but some of the particles get drawn towards the planet's poles, colliding with atmospheric gases.
The color of the lights depends on which types of gas the sun's charged particles run into. Green is most common and is caused by energized oxygen.
There's something profoundly satisfying about hearing the particulars of astrophysics laid out with diagrams, and then instantly being able to see a 360-degree image of the twinkling phenomenon itself, dancing over a dredge in Nome or the snowy birch trees of the interior. Professor Travis Rector is a geophysicist at the university and has a background in producing images of space that are science and art in equal measure. As part of a $1.4 million grant with the U.S. Department of Education, he worked with partners collecting the images and stories that anchor this planetarium show.
For a lot of people, the aurora are just these pretty lights that we see in the sky every now and then, especially for us down here in Anchorage where we don't see it as often. But for in the interior and up on the North Slope, the aurora are a daily part of their lives and a part of their culture. And so hearing the stories and learning about how they live with the aurora and how they use the auroras, that's really remarkable.
The show's called Kiyukayat and has a run at the UAA Planetarium, but it's also going to the North Slope and Northwest Arctic. Staff from the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks have a traveling planetarium that was described to me as a big inflatable bounce house with a projector inside, and that's what they'll be taking across the state. Rector says the school showings, those are the real point of the whole project.
The primary goal of the project is to share with Inupiaq children their heritage with the aurora. As time progresses, these stories start to get lost. And so making that connection between the stories of the elders to children is the primary goal.
The plan is to bring the Kiyukayat show to 20 rural communities before the end of the school year. Aurora fans in Anchorage can see a screening at the UAA Planetarium tonight and on February 24th. Or you can test your luck outside. For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Janelle Trowbridge from Nome. Trowbridge is a UAA student and Arctic Youth Ambassador who, almost a decade ago, sailed up to Alaska with her family from Michigan.
Like, ever since before I was born, my dad's like, sailboats. Like, my whole life, he's, you know, secretly dreaming of moving the whole boat on a boat and sailing away. So ever since I was little, we're downsizing, moving, downsizing, and moving. we didn't really have a set plan, but we didn't want to, he didn't really want to just go like to the Florida Keys and then just chill in the Florida Keys. He wanted to do something more adventurous, I guess. So on June 14, 2008, our family got on our 30-foot wooden sailboat and we left. And we went through the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway and a couple canals in there. And then we were to the ocean, to salt water. And we stopped in Newfoundland for a winter. And once he heard about the Northwest Passage, he started researching and started gathering different types of equipment and supplies. We had Precipice, that's the name of our boat, surrounded in ice. And we're like, okay, well, we could either like freak out and call the Coast Guard, but that's not really something we want to do, because that's serious, that's like aborting the adventure. What we did is we backed it up as far as we could in our little space and then rammed it on the ice, and it would get up on the ice and then crack the ice. And we kept doing this. And we were sailing towards Nome, and we had started having engine issues. We had a valve spring that would snap, engine's out of commission, but we're good, we're a sailboat, right? Mm-hmm. So then we're sailing, and then we get a huge storm. You know, we just wait out the storm, and then when we surface after it's died down a bit, our life raft, which we tow behind our boat, has been ripped off its harness, and it's who knows where, St. Lawrence Island by now. We're like, okay, we don't have an engine, we don't have a lifeboat, we should probably go to port. You know, Nome's the closest port. So we called in for the radio, and we asked for tow, and a fisherman came and towed us, and we traded him our bear gun, like a pump rifle, and there we were in Nome.
Janelle Trowbridge is from Nome. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, and Emily Russell in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
January 31st is the last day to enroll in the health insurance marketplace. For assistance in your area, go to getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.